It's Jimbo Times. I'm here with Marty Hillard of Ebony Tusks, and it is my absolute pleasure to be in this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast with you. Marty, we were saying a little bit about, we were talking a little bit about civic engagement and the way that we reach out to our communities, the way that we activate our communities. And I really see these movements intersecting. I see the music connecting with the prophecies, connecting with the aspirations of so many leaders who've come and gone and who've said to our communities, you know what, this country we make up, this culture we make up, these buildings we have put up, this is all ours once we claim that. And I hear a lot of this in your music. I hear a lot of this in your rap. And so, man, I just want to let the Los Cuentos listenership know that, like, to speak with Marty today is a true gift, because Marty's just entered his 41st year out here, and he has been quite busy with family life, with a whole lot of self-care, a whole lot of personal development. And to be here today right now is a privilege for both of us. So, man, really, I'm excited to introduce Los Angeles and listenership on this side of town, on this side of the world, to you and your work and your voice. So thank you again for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure. And just as much as I'm excited to, you know, be introduced to your audience, to your listenership, and, you know, it's also a privilege for me just to really firmly establish, you know, my connections on the West Coast and my love for LA and LA County, having only been there once in my lifetime, but, you know, having a grandfather who lived in Fresno, having an older cousin who's still with us in the Fresno area, and just, you know, a little bit of, you know, longing and melancholy that I've had over decades of time talking with my father about his estranged father. You know, a grandfather who I never met, and, you know, cousins and, you know, other relatives that I haven't had a chance to connect with. So for me, California is very much like, I feel spiritually connected to the state as much as I actually enjoy being there. So no, I'm just grateful just to be able to more firmly establish that connection with you and with your audience.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And tell me a little bit about where you're plugging in from today. Tell me a little bit about this portion of the Midwest that you call home. Tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. So I live in Topeka, Kansas. I'm about an hour west of the Kansas City metropolitan area, over on the Kansas side, of course. We are the capital city of Kansas, about 122 to 125,000 members of our population. As far as Shawnee County is concerned, we run about 177,000. So very much a capital city, like lots of other capital cities that I've been to, especially in the Midwest. One thing that's different about us is that we do have a university in the heart of central Topeka. However, our biggest university is the University of Kansas, that a lot of folks are familiar with. In Lawrence, Kansas, which is about 25 minutes to the east of us, and then Kansas City being another 40 minutes to the east of Lawrence. So I tend to call it the I-70 corridor, because we have a number of major cities that run along this corridor from central Kansas all the way into the Kansas City metropolitan area. So if we go from east to west, you know, starting in Kansas City, Missouri, Jackson and Johnson County, crossing over to KCK, which is Wyandotte County, hitting Lawrence, hitting Topeka, go a little bit further west, you pull into the Flint Hills, and then you hit Manhattan, which is the home of Kansas State University. just a little bit north of I-70. Go a little bit further west of that, you run into Salina. A little bit further west of that, you run into Hays. And then between Hays and Colorado, it's pretty quiet. But nevertheless, I want to shout out all of these communities because they're very much a reflection of what my whole experience has been, as a Topekan, as a Kansan. I've been fortunate to spend a lot of time in these various communities as a musician, as a professional, but also just as a human being. And I like to think, all of these communities and all of the memories and experiences that I've had all bleed into the music because of our shared compounded experiences being here. I've been in Topeka off and on since 1992. My family is originally from the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, Gulfport and Biloxi, and anybody who's been in and around the Gulf Coast should be familiar with that. Kind of sitting between New Orleans, Louisiana, and Mobile, Alabama. And so we have a lot of folks on the coast. Both sides of my family are originally from Biloxi. My grandmothers lived within 4 blocks of each other when they were both still with us. And then I have family running up to as far north as Jackson. But very much all of that is a big part of the music as well. I like to say that maybe the biggest artistic theme in my work over this long period of time has been a sense of displacement, and trying to create a sense of home and all of the things that home could possibly mean, in my music. So, whether that's, words like support, stability, consistency, loyalty, family. These are themes that crop up in the music, but also how home doesn't have to be fixed to, a structure or a building. That space making can happen anywhere at any time, which is reflected in the folks that are sort of maneuvering what I'm saying in the lyrics. Is that home can mean a lot of different things, and that sense of displacement can also mean a lot of different things. And so that's definitely what I'm channeling in the music, is very much like this mid-90s to early 2000s relationship that I have with the city of Topeka, and with the friends that I have that are still here, all the friends that I've lost over the last 30 years. Is very much a reflection of that.
Absolutely. Shout out to, as you said, the I-70 corridor and all of the communities who know this corridor, because I think a fundamental part of what we might call the working class experience is displacement, and also a lot of navigation through so many different compartments. I mean, you are talking to me about Topeka, but maybe there's some kind of, I don't know, state affair that you need to get to, which is all the way out in KC itself. And so there you have it. If not, you go from the University of Kansas to work in the bigger city because that's where the jobs tend to be. And that's where you establish friendships. That's where you head out to play all the shows and so on and so forth. But the communities that you come from also maintain this very special, even sacred place in your upbringing and in your memory. And so naturally you have to pay homage to them. Naturally, you got to shout them out. And I actually really like this about your work, is that everything is, I mean, going from one track to the next, everything is a shout out. Everything is like an acknowledgement, and you're collecting so much in one setting all at once. And so it can feel like this cacophonous melange of too many things going on, but yeah, there are too many things going on, and this is what it is to live, and it can be overwhelming. And I think for those of us who came up with that sound, especially in the 90s and the early 2Ks, you'll never forget that's that very sort of momentary lapse of belonging you felt when you were in the midst of the chaos, when you were in the midst of the melange, with others who were able to tune into that just as well. And so I very much hear that surviving through heal thyself. And I very much hear that permeating and letting the world know that this is still here, that this is still going on. And that's so refreshing in this moment for music where everything feels like a copy of a copy, where everything feels like we're just getting out the exact same product, time and again, slightly recycled. And yet here we have something that is fresh and something that is full of rage, full of authenticity, full of love and frustration all at once. And so, man, I'm out here in LA, but I can't wait to hit the next show, which is somewhere in the works, be it in Kansas City or be it in Wichita or be it in Topeka, because this is an experience that I think anyone who identifies as a working class person in this country needs to take part in, because there's also a euphoric aspect to it when you really get into the particulars of it. So I appreciate you shouting out all these various communities and noting that you're always keeping them in mind, because that shines in the music through and through. I gotta let you know right off the bat.
That's awesome. And that really means a lot too. It's anything that we've been able to do as a band, like with my bandmates Daniel and Geese, one of whom lives in Lawrence, one of whom lives in Kansas City, which again, that's also very much a reflection of what we're able to do as a band and the sound that comes out. It's very much like this collection of experiences, knowing that we live in these commuter communities. Knowing that we live in these commuter cities, knowing that our lives are somewhat suspended along the I-70 corridor because of how much time we spend in each other's communities. I mean, we have folks that have government jobs with the state of Kansas, that drive into the Capitol every single day or work for a state department, but they live in Lawrence, they live in Douglas County. Same thing in Kansas City. We have lots of folks that commute from Topeka or from Lawrence into the South Kansas City suburbs where there's a lot of jobs in Overland Park, Lenexa, Olathe, Shawnee Mission. And it's very much the reality for many musicians that I know and many creatives that I know is that in order to find these connections and to be able to establish these communal experiences, you're going to spend a lot of time traveling. One thing I'll say to Topeka's credit is that I had a lot of friends from a very early age, a couple of different collections of friends when I was in high school, which would have been from 1997 to 2001, the year I graduated. Where I was able to share that kind of music and kinship and very DIY kind of spirit. We're doing shows in friends' backyards, they're a little bit more affluent and they have the space to accommodate bands and rap artists playing. We would do shows in like clubhouses, in condominium communities, like gated communities, where my old DJ Brian Taylor used to live. We would do shows at like Boy Scout troops. And honestly, I mean, the 21 and up bar scene at that point in the late 90s was also very much embracing of this shift of young people wanting to make music. So I definitely have to give credit where credit was due. It's not that these environments were ideal for some of us, who started playing shows 14, 15, 16. 17, 18, but they were stages and they were opportunities, and I definitely have to give credit to that. House shows, all my friends over on Lincoln Street in Central Topeka, and then also churches. Churches were a big thing. A lot of us, a lot of me and my friends grew up in the church, having had that experience, and again, wanting to express ourselves. Of course, in many cases through the lens of Christianity, in some cases not. But There were churches at the time that were certainly, open, somewhat welcoming to the idea of having live music and young people express themselves. So again, it's just this combination of, a sense of urgency, and desire and passion for wanting to express ourselves, and by any means necessary, finding stages that could accommodate that, and proprietors, bar owners, spaces that could make that happen. I remember some of the biggest shows that. Let me kind of start from the beginning.
Let us
In
know. Break
19,
it down.
yeah, so like 1998, I would have been 15, and played in my first band, The Original, which was kind of like a like hip hop funk, like heavy, like vaguely nu metal kind of thing. I remember my DJ Brian was really an Aesop Rock, and our drummer Brian, oh gosh, yeah, Brian Curran, yeah, great guy, real spiritual, like early on, like somebody who really tapped me into wanting to maintain that independent of like what religion or like he was somebody who I think reaffirmed me in a really great way that still resonates with me now, allowed me to make an album like Heal Thyself, somebody's influence like that. But and then our bass player Seth Todd, we had a couple of different guitarists early on. Our buddy Ricky Labrador, who was very much into nu metal, Limp Bizkit, like Wes Borland was his hero. He left the band at a certain point, and then one of my best friends, who sadly passed away, at the age of 45 last April, Jeff Ensley. He was our second guitarist, possibly like my greatest like personal influence as far as music. Somebody who never told me no. Somebody who always would embrace me and introduce me to lots of different cool music. But that's what we were doing. We were kind of doing like this live hip hop thing. We would enter every talent show that we had at our high school, and we had a number of them because we have lots of different student organizations that would host fundraisers and put together different opportunities. So our Black Student Union, then we had our student run organization SRO, the American Foreign Exchange Student Club would also have an annual Battle of the Bands. And so yeah, that was something early on, like we knew to take advantage of those opportunities as they came, and that was something that we were really into. That was probably also like the first band that I played in Kansas City with. We played this old church basement called New Earth Coffee House, and that's just a whole other universe. And I'm grateful to still have friends from that period of time, and we've definitely lost some folks from that time too. But I think that was the first time where I felt like, oh, this is something that I could actually do, even from here in Topeka, where the vision isn't always clear and the door isn't always open. I can take what I'm doing to other communities and connect with other people there. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, especially on that note, I want to ask you a little bit about that, say, Genesis story, because you're talking about participating or throwing your hat in the ring at this early point in your life, in your teen years. And I want to ask you a little bit about when you first came to recognize a talent for music, as in like, are you like hanging out somewhere and you got do you have a notepad and are you scribbling some things down? I'm curious a little bit about when you first discovered your own talent for this work.
December 26th, 1994, I wrote my first rap. I wrote it to impress my older brother Dimitri. He was in the military. He was in the Navy, and his last station was in Jacksonville, Florida, in the early 90s. He attended church pretty regularly then, and he was like really connected with the church he was going to in Jacksonville. He and two others formed a rap group called Golden Street Gangsters. I remember him sending me a VHS of one of their performances at the church. And I mean, like, they looked like a rap group. They looked like a team, like a squad, head to toe. They had a bandana, big denim, like denim vest, and like arms hanging out, you know, loose baggy jeans, but it was also like, you know, again, like on the Christian hip hop tip. So like that was, I mean, prior to that, you know, we were a family that enjoyed music, and you know, my dad always had music in the house, and I loved music from a very early age, of course, but I think that was the first time where I realized, like, wow, like that's something I actually want to do. I would have been in middle school by then. So if it was 94, I mean, I would have been in sixth grade. I would have just started sixth grade when he sent that. He came home for the holidays, and while he was home, I wrote that rap the day after Christmas. I showed it to him, and you know, we talked, knowing that he was going to be there for an extended stay. Like, we talked about it, we prayed about it. Like, should we start a rap group? And then we did. It was called DM in Effect. So then we started having performances at local churches, any kind of community event. I remember us performing at like Central Park Community Center in Central Topeka. Right by Robinson Middle School. That was the first time a lot of my friends in the neighborhood I grew up in were exposed to what I was doing. Because the truth is, we were going to church across town, way in South Topeka, like big multicultural, non-denominational, very Pentecostal leaning kind of church, church body. And so, you know, even there was a sense of displacement because, I mean, historically, there are a number of like Black churches in Central Topeka that you know, we opted not to go to. Like, you know, we went to this church in South Topeka, and it's been nice, even, you know, as I've gotten older, to be able to rekindle some of those relationships, you know, with those folks, and the folks that were my age that, you know, their parents and their grandparents were going to church in Central Topeka, but I was going all the way to South Topeka, you know. But that's really where it started for me. I mean, prior to that, I would sing in the church with my sister, and we would always rehearse, and she would tell me, like, don't mess up the harmony, like, you like focus, and she made me take it very seriously. So I mean, parallel to that, and this is a story for another time, but parallel to that, I started after DM in Effect with my brother, and after the original with my high school buddies, I started a folk project. Where I was playing acoustic guitar and touring the Midwest for the first time from 2000 to 2005, called the Sister Maria. I named it after my sister because, again, paying homage to her influence on my life and her want to hear me sing, you know, I kind of carried those memories with me into that project. So, yeah, it's something that, yeah, I identified it at an early age, and thankfully, you know, it was something that my parents, you know, seemed to support at an early age. I think it was much later on, after I got a little bit better, you know, as a musician, as a composer, and a recording artist, and then also garnered a little bit of success. I think that's when it really started to click for my parents. Like, oh, this actually is for real, you know. But nevertheless, yeah, just knew it at a very early age and followed it, you know, as long as I could, and wherever it took me. So,
I think that's so great. I didn't expect you to have the date on hand like that, but
I got the notebook. I got the notebook with the first rap.
so
Here's the
much power
deal.
to it.
And here's the deal, right? Okay, Exhibit, paparazzi. I used to watch that on Rap City every time it came on, and he's standing on the beach, you know, the dysfunctional member, you know, of the Liquid Crew, and then it's got the symphony, you know, the orchestra in the background sitting on the beach, and it's all windy, and you know, and they're playing the string sample, and that was the song. That was the song. I mean, like, lots of other music, of course, that I took in and ingested and enjoyed, but that was the first time, like, hearing Exhibit's voice and what he was talking about on the song was like an epiphany to me. And that was where it was like, oh, like rap could be like this. Like, rap could be something that's very sincere and deliberate and aggressive and meaningful. You know, that's still just like one of my favorite hip hop songs. Like, yeah, I it was it was so it was Exhibit, Listening to the Beatniks, so like hopping over to the other coast, really into the Beatniks, definitely into the Alcoholics, even as as an underage person. And but very quickly, because of the work I was doing with my brother, we would the Christian hip hop community was very small in this area. And so we quickly joined forces with like a good buddy of mine, Chris Kopp, a good buddy of mine, Jace Jacob, who were in a duo called Subterranean Misfits. Jace's father, Lonnie, was again somebody who provided platforms, like literally provided stages for us to be able to go into Central Topeka, into East Topeka, into Southeast Topeka, and perform for Christian audiences and church audiences. He had all the equipment, and he was also very much like a revivalist, a lot like my parents were. So like that was something where our families really synced up really quickly. And so yeah, it would either be a revival tent or not, but there was a stage there. And yeah, so we hooked up with those guys. I got a shout out, my buddy Michael Graham and my buddy Jason Cohen, who are, we made up a crew called the Decipher Crew, that was born out of that. And so we did a lot of stuff together, and I'm really grateful for them because I definitely remember the first time I heard Lytyrics, because of Jason Cohen. We were in high school, and we used to be able to carry headsets around, and I was a library proctor, so I would spend a lot of time in the library just searching music. And he was the one who put me on to Lytyrics' self-titled album, which is life-changing. Remember the first time I heard the Beneath the Surface compilation, just hanging out with those guys, because they were also a little bit older than me, so they were the first people to like to have their own houses and like have their own apartments and stuff. So yeah, so Lytyrics, Beneath the Surface, Freestyle Fellowship, of course, AC Alone, Book of Human Language. Golly, man. And I'm trying to think what else. But definitely like some of that like real foundational, fundamental, like Good Life Cafe, like that's the stuff that we all seem to really connect with. On the flip side of that coin, good buddy of mine, Stick Figga, like one of my best friends to this day, John Westbrook Jr. He lives in Texas now. He's gone on to have like a really incredible, like storied underground career as a hip hop artist, signed with Mellow Music back in like the early 2010s, put out an album with L'Orange called The City Under the City, which is incredible. Central Standard Time, with Mellow Music, put out tons of independent music with Conductor Williams, who, we knew him as D. Will, out of Kansas City, for many years, but everybody knows him as Conductor Williams now. But so like Stick and I, living on opposite ends of like the same block for a while, we made a lot of music together too. And he was very much like a more like East Coast influence artist at the time. So at that point, that's going to be like Cannabis. That's going to be Capone and Noriega. That's going to be like Cam'ron and his whole movement with the Diplomats. That's going to be Beanie Siegel, State Property. Freeway, God, like, I mean, Philly, especially like battle artists, had me in a chokehold for a while. Like anybody who saw Meek Mill like back in 2006, like with the braids, like with the nappy braids, and like in and out of jail, knows what I'm talking about. It's just a different ferocity that was demanded of hip hop artists at the time, and that was something I think that. Living in like kind of a hard-nosed Midwestern city without a lot of prospects for creativity, I think that was something that resonated with us. But I also can't ignore the influence of like West Coast artists like Be Legit or E-40 or Too Short or Rappin' Forte, Sugar Free, Mac Dre. I mean, like we're this close to Kansas City, right? And so there was a big like expat movement of folks from California into our Midwestern communities back in the early 90s as well. I don't want to say that there was a pure correlation to all of the gang and gun violence that was happening then, but those things are interwoven in our psyches, in this community, knowing that, there were real gangsters, who moved here from California and brought gang culture in a real way into Topeka, into Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas, into Jackson and Johnson County in Kansas City, Missouri. You hear that in Tech N9ne's music, because he spent all of that time in California in like the late 80s and the early 90s. And so just thinking about, that composite of like, West Coast, like street rap, like real like gritters, versus really cerebral, East Coast hip hop, but also like some of the fly flashy Harlem shit too. But then like, like that purest form of the LA underground, that we're all descendants of from like the 1990s, it that's kind of what for me is like what has proven to be like, my most enduring influences is like just that combination. And of course, like, I found myself like also enjoying, artists like Aesop Rock, artists like Rob Sonic, LP, is like one of my favorite rap writers. Everything that he and Killer Mike have done has run the jewels. Like I have friends that I think are maybe like fatigued about it, but it's just like this is everything that I ever wanted is was to see some real MCs get to it, And it's like they deserve to be celebrated. I just don't. I've also had a very different relationship to music than a lot of people that I know in terms of, me wanting to be a fan first and me wanting to be a student and somebody who really appreciates it from a cultural standpoint. I like to think that also reflects in the music as well. I've been talking for a while. I'm sorry.
I love it. You're a natural storyteller. You are a natural storyteller, and that's why the rap and the music, both of these are mediums. These are mediums that you navigate through as a storyteller because there's a lot on your mind. I mean, even as you describe this, what I've gotten is, especially when you know the importance of Christian hip hop in your life at that very early point in your life, and then the way that Topeka changes, the way that you and your friends all grow up, and the very different courses that life will take you all on. I hear all of these things permeating in such an important way. And who of us who have, say, survived this mass trauma, the mass displacement, the gang culture, the policing culture, the drugs, all of the various elements that surround working class communities of color, especially out there, but not just working class communities of color, these working class white communities all through the Midwest just as well.
That's right.
We have so much to say, and we need to find an outlet. And sometimes I think it also feels very much like when you're getting into these stories, you have to be honest. You have to let your people know where you're coming from. You have to shout out as many of your roll call as you can, because that's what you would want for any other survivor to do out there. You'd want them to let the whole city know, to let everybody know that we were here, and that to the extent that we can tell it today, that we're still here. So, Marty, tell me a little more about the Christian hip hop community as you have evolved through it in the Midwest and through the I-70 corridor, as you were saying. Tell me a little bit about this world because I very much appreciate the connection that you've maintained to this part of your life, this part of your identity, this part of your upbringing. And I think our listeners would appreciate hearing some more about it just as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's interesting in particular is that, I mean, there was definitely a significant period of time where I was maybe like trying to run away from having that history or trying to distance myself from it. trying to recontextualize my work and like what I was doing as a hip hop artist through like a different lens. But no, I feel like I've got a healthy relationship and understanding historically of like what that's meant to me. And I had mentioned the Decipher Crew. I know that we went to see Nashville recording artist Grits years ago. They've been in the game for over 30 years, former Goatee Record signees. So that would be like Toby McKeon of DC Talk, his label. That was pretty prominent like in Christian hip hop back in the early to mid 90s. So a big fan of like their first two albums, and I still love them. Like Factors of the Seven, I think that came out in 1997, where they introduced a lot of folks to Notaverbs, and also made that West Coast connection back to like Tunnel Rats, back to LPG and those artists through that album. So yeah, I would say like being able to see them. I got to cipher with those guys when I was, oh man, this would have been like, I don't know, 1999. So I'd have been like 16, maybe 2000. So I'd have been 17. It's very surreal, but I mean, like, again, just coming with that, like that passion and, that heart for expression. I just remember them giving me like, just some real kind compliments, and whether they meant them or not, it's just the fact that like, just lifting up a young person in a really vulnerable situation, like you're in your like mid to late 20s, and this is just a kid like just jumping in the cipher. Like, I was just so proud of myself. But yeah, as far as like fellow Christian hip hop artists, we Decipher Crew was linked up with Mad Prophets out of Kansas City, and the majority of them, I want to say, were from like the South Kansas City suburbs, like I had mentioned earlier. North Kansas City generally is called the Northland, so you might hear me refer to it as that. But anytime we linked up with them, like we were generally like in South Kansas City, like in Raytown, which is maybe like 10, 15 minutes south of downtown Kansas City. But yeah, so we would trade dates at churches doing shows and stuff. And I can't say that like Christian hip hop garnered a lot of respect at that point in time from the church or from like mainstream listeners. Like I would be that would be silly to pretend like it was anything other than that. It was definitely an uphill battle, especially when you talk about going to a high school like we did, Topeka High School, which is at the time I want to say it was about like 1,700 students, and about 2,000 folks in the building every day. And I know that that number since has gone up in the last 25 years. But yeah, I mean, I would definitely say that like having that stance and coming with that approach was like an uphill battle on all sides, which I think a lot of more prominent Christian hip hop artists could relate to at the time. I remember like there was like cross movement, and gosh, there was like a record label in the South that took on like Master P's kind of template, where they had like all the like the Pen and Pixel album covers, and but it was all Christian, right? I cannot remember the name of that label. But nevertheless, yeah, Tunnel Rats was definitely like a huge influence on us, a huge influence on me, because it was just like such a dazzling display of like official like West Coast hip hop. I mean, that's a crew that's still around. I just ordered LPG's The Earthworm on vinyl for the first time because Peace 586, he's been producing like almost 40 years, living in Hawaii. And he was like on his IG, he was like, "Hey, this is available on vinyl for the first time, and then you'll get a free copy of like my new instrumental album." And so I messaged all, the Decipher Crew members, and I was like, we got to get this. So like four of us got copies of the album just because like that's how real it is, But I think for us, it really illuminated our understanding not only of like hip hop culture at large, but also like what a Christian MC could be, what a Christian hip hop artist could be. So not only Tunnel Rats, but then like LA Symphony, Pigeon John was a huge influence on my art. At an early age. And And LA Symphony, they came to Kansas City and played New Earth way back in the day. I think when their album Composition One came out, Pigeon John toured through the area and came to New Earth a couple of times. And then as he started to like navigate the mainstream, you know, he was coming on bigger tour packages. I think he came out with like No Can Do one time and played Lawrence to like 20 people. And that was crazy. Like, that's crazy to think about now, but like, it was just like, you know, we were chilling. I would definitely say, Christian hip hop was definitely a big influence, but you know, we were somewhat isolated in what was already a very isolated genre. Which you know, which led us to start like spreading our wings, branching out. Like I had mentioned Stick Figure earlier, he was the first one to really get us connected with Lawrence in Kansas City and in those hip hop scenes. Just because just his talent level was through the roof, and he just garnered so much respect everywhere he went. He was definitely like the best battle MC of all of us. And so like being able to like follow his lead into some of these places, like I remember Downplay Productions, why can't I remember his name, out of Lawrence. They like they primarily book shows out of Lawrence, and so they were bringing in all kinds of underground MCs, you know, from all over the country, but particularly from the West Coast, you know, at that point in time. They were doing shows at Fatso's. They were doing shows at Replay Lounge. They did a lot of shows at the Pool Room, which I never figured out a way to make it to. But they definitely put on for us in a way that allowed us to be exposed to like just so much of what the underground had to offer. I remember seeing like Prince Paul, the Prince Among Thieves tour. I remember seeing, you know, my OG approach open up for the Visionaries and DJ Rhetmatic at the Bottleneck. I know I'm jumping around, but like there's just so much to tell. Approach is
Course,
probably
of
like my,
course.
yeah, and Approach is probably my biggest influence, you know, as a performing artist, because he's the first person that I saw perform hip hop aggressively with love in his heart, with just like a maximum amount of love, which is where his aggression was coming from, is like, you know, this is not going to be some bullshit. You are going to get involved. Like, we're going to turn up the temperature. And he's the first person that I saw do that in a way that like felt loving and felt welcoming. And I'll just never forget that performance where he opened up for Visionaries, and every, you know, and everybody was like real hype on them at the time. It was definitely like, you know, real hip hop kind of situation.
Visionaries.
Yeah, and he was and everybody was kind of playing the wall, you know, while he was performing. And he at one point he told his DJ, he was like, nope, run it back, we're starting over, we need you to get involved, like get your hands up, come up. And like, I don't know, like I just had such a big smile on my face, because that was the first time where I understood that like I don't necessarily have to be hard or unnecessarily aggressive as an MC to get people involved. Like, I can just project a lot of love and a lot of joy and a lot of affection for the moment. And Approach taught me that at a very early age. I'd have been in my early 20s at the time. So it's like, you know, we transitioned, you know, from high school and from like, you know, doing Christian hip hop into, you know, and just more in the secular world, more in the mainstream world. But again, because we were all so hungry as MCs, we were really fortunate that it garnered us a lot of respect.
With this in mind, especially because you're talking to me about the late 90s, early 2Ks, and you're telling me about your progression from your high school days onto your early 20s, especially as more and more artists began to cluster all across the country during their tours and so on. I have to ask you about the reception of 8 Mile as a film in your community and through your networks, because I think especially when you're talking to me about actually jumping into a cypher with like a bunch of older, more experienced, seasoned cats, like that in and of itself, I think has to be one of the proudest moments for a young person to be able to reflect back on, because I mean, there's nothing more elemental than jumping into a circle of these strangers slash friends slash members of the community and spitting alongside them, telling a story, making your contribution to the noise, to the rhythm, to the spiritual aspect of that coming together. And so for me, part of the legacy of 8 Mile is its recognition of the cipher, its constant positioning of the cipher as such a fundamental aspect of especially that grungy hip hop scene through the 90s and into the early 2Ks. So I have to ask you a little bit about what that was like for you all over on your side of Topeka and the I-70 corridors.
Absolutely. That's a great question. Only because like it brings back so many memories. And I think for us, like the concept, the idea of the cipher predated 8 Mile by quite a bit of time, because I remember again in high school with Stick Figure, because of the caliber of MC he was, even when we were in high school. We used to have what was called Freestyle Fridays. This was before 106 and Park. This is when like Rap City was still on, you know? And so along Western Avenue, the Western Avenue entrance and exit to Topeka High School, there was like a big tree and a number of benches that you could sit at. And after school on Fridays, we would all get under those trees, and anybody who wanted to battle could get it. And there were kids who came from Highland Park. There were kids who came from Topeka West, who came from other parts of the city because they knew that we were getting down like that, and they were battling Stick. So for us, I mean, as far as experiencing hip hop, like, I mean, the Cypher was like the earliest example of what it meant to like express ourselves, especially like once we got into like the larger hip hop communities, like in Lawrence and Kansas City at the time. I mean, like if you ever wanted to get on stage, like you weren't going to be able to get on stage until you got in Cypher. If you wanted to participate in a rap battle, like you would not be able to sign up for that battle until you were in a Cypher off stage. And I mean, that was also at a time where like, DJs were spinning, all, just hot plates at the time, all the instrumentals that a lot of us could really get busy on, And so in between traveling acts, touring acts, the DJ would, go for like 20 minutes, and it would just be like two or three ciphers happening all at once, And you would just sort of navigate, like, in a very literal sense, go from cipher to cipher to see who was like really getting busy and like making noise. So for us, like, our experience with 8 Mile was more like a reflection of something that we already knew and understood quite well. And also like reaffirmed our experience as like Midwest MCs who really did it because we loved it. And back, when kids thought, our peers thought it was like really corny to like stand around on the corner and like rap with your friends, it just reaffirmed and validated a lot of our earliest experiences. And that was really cool. I think it tells the story of Detroit through a really interesting lens. It's very much like the Detroit that it was depicting at the time is very much a reflection of what lots of Midwestern American cities that saw their manufacturing and their processing plants go away, that saw these jobs and opportunities go away, that saw these hollowed out buildings, that saw crumbling infrastructure, that saw just a really lethargic civic attitude. And so for us, I mean, it was like wow, like somebody's finally telling our story. I mean, for all the Nellies of the world, being from St. Louis, or like the Cuckoo Cows from Milwaukee, or the Bone Thugs and Harmony from Cleveland, like I think that was the first one that really captured what like post mid-century America was like in the Midwest for a lot of folks prior to the 21st century. And I think it was more just like more than anything, we just appreciated it. I think we just appreciated Eminem, appreciated D12. I mean, long live Proof. Like, Mekhi Phifer's depiction of Proof in that in that movie is like, that's more of our stories than the Eminem. You know, obviously, we have a lot of dope MCs, legendary MCs that no one's ever heard of, and folks that some people have heard of, but like for a lot of us, I mean, more of us are Mekhi than, or I'm sorry, more of us are Proof than we are of them. And so in that way, it was also really validating to see somebody who is just like, I believe in you, I support you this much, I'm here for you, I'm rocking with you, I'm making sure people know who you are before they even know who I am. And I think that was a big part of it as well, that we all appreciated in the Midwest. Definitely like up the Cypher energy for a little while, but it was something that we were already doing. It was something that was already happening in our cities and communities, so it was really cool to just see it on a big screen like that.
And because you mentioned Exhibit earlier, I think it had to have been really cool to see this MC playing a character in the Midwest out there, this rapper or this worker who raps, who's got a whole lot of talent, who's nonetheless just another Joe out there taking the bus, getting through his shift. And finding a way to pass the time where he can. To see Exhibit take on that role and do it so well, also told you a little bit about how these other rappers, they were talented in a variety of ways, not just when it came to their skills on the microphone, but also on the big screen. And I thought, like, that's so cool. It's so cool to showcase that, especially a Mekhi, especially an Exhibit, they have so many stories to tell if you give them that opportunity. And at least here on the West Coast, it was kind of around the time of Training Day as well, with Denzel Washington. And similarly for us in LA, to see the streets of Los Angeles captured, the culture of LA captured in this way, and Denzel making his way through, man, that felt visceral. That felt like it was right on the money. And so, yeah, naturally I had to ask you about 8 Mile, as you tell me a little bit about this upbringing for you through your side of the Midwest.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Just ne neglect is something that definitely resonated with all of us. I mean, like a lot of us who live on river cities, here in the Midwest, are all too familiar with like sides of town that fall under duress and neglect. I think we're also very fortunate that in the Midwest that there was a point in time where it was very clear that everybody's disposable income is shrinking. And I think a lot of like civic leaders and civic organizations have made a very concerted effort in creating like not only civic engagement but civic pride in their communities. So we've seen lots of really great things happen in Lincoln and Omaha, Nebraska. We've seen really cool things happen in Des Moines, Iowa. I mean, I have friends there who refer to their city as very much an island, the biggest city in Iowa. And nevertheless, because it's in the heart of everything, it also means that it's a little bit isolated from like the rest of the Midwest too. But we've seen a lot of cities opt to turn inward because the truth of the matter is, if they don't, those cities will disappear. That those ways of life and those traditions will disappear. And so I feel like everybody, especially in the last like 20 years, has made a concerted effort to create not only more stable economies, but more accessibility. Lot, obviously lots of rebrands for a lot of these Midwest cities as well. The reality is, I mean, so much of it like cycles around what corporate entities have also like decided to invest in your communities. So, we have a Mars plant. Frito-Lay and Goodyear have been here for years. We've got five Walmarts in town, which I think a lot of people would say is very excessive, but it also helps with regard to accessibility for folks who aren't in a position to get from, 29th in California on the southeast side of town, all the way out west to 17th and Wanamaker. So it's like, as we see one part of our civic identity, of our collective memory, start to fade, there's lots of new things that begin all of the time, right or wrong, good or bad. There's always something happening, at least changing from a visual standpoint. As I get older, I realize, the truth that, not much materially or even spiritually changes in, even over 75 or 100 years. I mean, we've had so many different technological advances that we're able to reap the benefits of, but we've also seen, at least here in Topeka, we've seen urban renewal, through our downtown and central Topeka communities, completely change the landscape for poor Black, brown, and white people, irreversibly. And there have been a lot of solutions put forth about, what can we do to, what leverage do we have to bring some of these communities back to their former prominence? How can we create more opportunities for people in these communities to be more self-sufficient and to have more access to the things they want and need? But the reality of that, I mean, just like in Detroit, is that, it takes a lot of corporate dollars. It takes tons of capital. And not just dollars and cents, it takes lots of human capital. So even, when these, subjectively good things are happening in our Midwest communities, there are still a lot of people who make the greatest investment that also don't get a chance to reap the full benefits of what these changes are that occur. And I'm sure you see that all over Los Angeles County, all the different ways that it's probably changed and morphed, culturally, spiritually, infrastructure-wise, and yet there are people that are generationally poor that will remain so, despite all of the access that we have to technology and all of the information that we have available at our fingertips, because capital is hard to bypass. It's not impossible. People power matters a lot,
I like
but
that so much. I like that so much. Now, actually, on the subject of change and on the subject of the culture, given a little bit of spotlight out there, I want to ask you about how Bel-Air first reached out to you. I'm so curious about this because if you're on the LA side and if you haven't checked out Bel-Air just yet, I absolutely recommend you do. If I hadn't checked out Bel-Air, I would not have come across Ebony Tusks and Schuyler of Ebony Tusks. So I got to ask you a little bit about how that connection first came to be and how it may have surprised you when somebody from their team reached out.
Morgan Cooper, the creator and executive producer, alongside, the Horowitzes and like all the original folks, who retain all of those the Fresh Prince assets. Morgan Cooper's from Kansas City. He's from
Wow.
Grandview, Missouri, which is about, I want to say, 30 minutes south of the metro. Much, even for a suburb, like much smaller community than Topeka is. And he, we had the pleasure of working with him previously on some other audio visual projects. And it was something where he knew, before he moved out to LA, he was like, this is what I'm gonna go do, and this is what I have planned, and anybody who wants to come along with me. And so it was one of those things where he's been very diligent, and then also his music supervisor, Johnny Stark, originally is from Kansas City as well. So these were like ongoing conversations that we had had with them over a very long period of time. but they had also had with lots of other like Kansas City based artists. I think they were very serious about getting as much of Kansas City into Bel Air as they could, which they did in some regards. And for us, so the first outreach was, let's get the album cover in our record store, like for like one of the first episodes. And so I got to shout out Justin Bergen.
Hey.
An incredible fine artist based in Wisconsin, near Madison. But anyway,
Recognize it.
yeah, exactly. But so they reached out to us specifically about the album cover, and we were just really excited. It's like, cool, like we'll get this physical asset in the background, and that'll be awesome. And then they came back around and said, hey, there's a couple of songs we'd like to see if they fit in the show.
Wow.
And it was just like, oh yeah, absolutely. And of course, like navigating that world, I mean, like, being in contact with NBC Universal, I mean, there's layers to it. I mean, there were definitely like five or six people that we were communicating with from start to finish over like, almost a year period. Thankfully, Jeff McCoy from High Dive Records, another Kansas City based label who we've worked closely with through the release of Heal Thyself. He retains the mastering rights. We retain the publishing rights, and so we were both able to enjoy payment from that. But it was also like when I saw like the closing credits of that episode, I was like, I couldn't be more thrilled that wow, it's like somebody on their team was like really mindful of where we should be placed, in the vast dichotomy that is the Bel-Air universe being created in real time, So it was such a pleasure, and got a shout out Morgan for thinking enough of us to put us in that position. Very proud of what he's been able to do. I know I can't imagine, like how much pressure, he must feel or has felt over the years. I know not everybody's had the same experience that we've had, with him, and that's not to. I'm just being honest, and that's just the reality of like, going from Kansas City to Hollywood, I imagine, is that, there's a lot of compromise happening there. But I am, to his credit and to Johnny and everybody on their team's credit, they did right by us, and we're very grateful for that. I couldn't have been more thrilled, especially, at this late stage in my life, my musical life, that because it did bring a lot of really cool conversations that I got to have with like lots of different people, who picked us up on us for the first time from that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I couldn't be more thankful that that was something that happened for us. So.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm likewise thankful. I hadn't known that Cooper was actually originally out of KC like that. So
It's crazy,
big
crazy.
facts.
Yeah, it's crazy, and I mean, he's also an incredible MC. Him and Conductor Williams, they had a duo where they put out a couple of albums under Cooper's chosen moniker, Barrel Maker. And so, yeah, there was a point in time where we were doing shows with them as well. And that was just such a pleasure, just watching Morgan come into his own as an MC, somebody who wrote for just like a really, really long time before he decided to like come out and showcase his abilities. That also happened in a cipher. And it's just like I think we were all just blown away because like we knew like his audio visual talent, and we knew he had an ear for making music, but like just seeing him show up the way that he did, I mean, it's been just phenomenal, like watch him scale up in the way that he has. So
Man, that is so great. Now, I had the feeling that I really wanted to break bread with you. So I felt like I wanted to meet you and also just hear from you and have a session, kind of like by the fireside with you. And it has been just that. I'm grateful for this because you need this kind of convo in your life. You need this kind of convo in your work. You need to meet with folks who have similar interests, but who are going to tell you about a different layer of the onion. And that's exactly
yeah.
what you're schooling me up on right now. And man, I'm all here
I
for it.
appreciate that. It feels good. It feels good to share these stories, but also, like you said, just to be able to break bread with you and learn a little bit more about you, and see LA through your eyes as well. I mean, it's very like, I have my perspective and it's very idyllic. And I spent some time in Pasadena and Mount Washington
Hey,
and
love
Fullerton.
Pasadena.
Pasadena was, oh my God. It was
I
that was
know.
like that was like heaven on earth for a second. I couldn't afford anything, but it was like it was hella chill. I enjoyed
I
being
know
out
the
there.
feeling. We know the feeling.
Yeah, but gosh. I went out there August of 2021. I have some friends, the majority of whom live out in LA. They're in a band called Hembree.
Okay.
And so I sold merch from them like a couple of years prior to that at a big Kansas City festival that happens in the summer called Boulevardia. So this is pre-COVID, right? So this would have been like 2019. And I sold merch for them. And one of my old friends, Alex Ward, who plays in the band, he was like, how you been doing lately? And I was just telling him, I was struggling. I was, before Heal Thyself had come out, I wasn't really sure if it was going to come out, like if we were even going to get it finished. And, just like really depressed. And I told him, I was like, like art and like work wasn't going really well at the time either. I was like, like I'd just been really down. I've been suicidal. And he gave me a hug and is like, I'm sorry to hear that. They played a hell of a set that day. But they reached out to me, in the middle of the pandemic. So this had been summer 2020. Isaac Flynn, lead singer of that band, reached out to me and was like, hey, I got a song I think it would be perfect on. They're recording their second album. They're just like, we want to do something that's more like Gorillaz, where we have special guests and get a lot of our friends involved. And I was like, okay, bet. Like, I'm excited about that. So we record a song called Operators. And then the following summer, 2021, they were like, hey, so like we're shooting this music video. Do you want to come out to LA and shoot it with us? And I was like, oh yeah, absolutely. I had been to San Francisco before. That's probably my favorite city in the world. Just really gorgeous. And I mean, this was before like the housing boom, the housing crisis and the housing boom. So I don't know if I could ever afford to go back to San Francisco, but that would have been like 2006. But anyway, fast forward to 2021. Song's been done for a year. There's like, we're gonna put out the album later this year. You want to do the single? And I was like, cool, yeah. So went out there with them, we stayed near Pasadena. I stayed with Alex and his brother Austin in their place. And then Isaac and his wife live in Mount Washington, just south of there.
Yeah.
And so we were bouncing back and forth between Pasadena, Mount Washington, and Fullerton. And so we went to a recording studio just so we could film and capture a live performance of the song. And the sax player, his name is, I want to say his name is Warren Wong. And he, his handle on IG is War Dog with two G's.
Right on.
Anyway, he was heading back out to like Arcadia and he was like, yo, like I can give you a ride to Pasadena on the way, just because I wanted to take a day for myself. And he dropped me off in Pasadena and I was just like, the weather couldn't have been better. Just really mild, really beautiful. Folks like us in the Midwest, I mean, like we're easily impressed. So I had to go to H&M.
Folks like
Yeah,
us in the Midwest, we're easily impressed.
dude, I got dissed so bad one time in San Francisco. Like I was talking with my mom over the phone, and this was around the holidays, and I was at a bus stop, and she was telling me how she went to like Olive Garden. And I was like, oh, was your meal at all, just being polite, talking to my mom, just like, was your meal at Olive Garden good? And this girl who was sitting next to me at the bus stop, she was like, Olive Garden? Oh, y'all must be from the Midwest. And I was like, oh my God. And so I was like, damn, like really? But I know we're kind of, we're corny, but I remember going to a liquor store back when I drank. I'm almost 3 years sober now, but
Congratulations.
thank you so much. I appreciate it. But I just remember just grabbing a couple of Lucy's and like going and sitting in the park, and there was like a sound shell where a homeless person was just singing. just standing in the sound shell and just singing, using
Mm.
their natural voice. And I
Right,
just
right,
remember
right,
like
right.
sitting in the park and drinking like this orange flavored beer and feeling like, man, again, it was like one of those moments where it's like, oh, I feel like I'm home a little bit,
Oh, 100.
Yeah, just
100.
like that displacement that I feel, that estrangement that I feel from like my California side of the family. It was like, I get it now. I feel somewhat connected to it because I'm taking some time to just be present in this moment, have this beer, to distort my mind a little bit, just enjoy the sunshine and just take in the sounds of the city and like see the mountain range in the distance, hear this person in the sound shell, hear the sirens down the street, and everybody in the park is looking around like, what's going on? I just felt like so present, for that couple of hours I was out there. And that's a lot of what, the 3 or 4 days I was in LA, that's definitely what it felt like. Just an opportunity, like not only for me to shoot this video with my friends and with this great videographer named Coco, but to just be present, and to be able to just sort of take it in, which has become increasingly important, like as I've gotten older, that you have to like pause, be present. Not every moment has to be like sort of filled with these very specific meaning or like this very specific mile marker, like we did this on this or this is what happened this. I think it just you just have to show up for it and just be willing to, just let it breathe a little bit. That's very much how I experience the world. Like anytime I'm in a new city, I don't do this as much anymore.
Sure.
Anytime I'm in a new city, I will walk and walk and walk
Yes.
and get lost. And I mean, there's been plenty of times where that's worked out really well. There's been plenty of times that it's been to my detriment. But when I've been in New York City, or when I've been in Logan Square in Chicago, or even in Des Moines, like with our punk homies in Des Moines, like we stayed at their house, and it's like, well, I'm just gonna walk for about a mile and a half and just kind of see what this is and just get a sense for how people live here. I did that a lot in Omaha. Like I've so many. I'll send you the link. There's this duo called Mean Street, and the MC is a guy named Brenton Gomez. His rap name is Conscience, and we call him Connie. And he's easily like the best poet, best MC that I've ever met in my life,
Wow.
and like somebody that just the clarity. Like I just aspire to his like willingness to just just be clear. I'd be very blunt in his raps. He's the same kind of MC that I am. That like when he raps about Omaha, it's like I could see it vividly. When he talks about growing up in Midtown and living in Midtown, talks about all the Hispanic and Latino communities in South Omaha, it's like I can see it. And he was an MC that I definitely aspired to. He's on You Runner on our album, and it's the same thing. It's like he showed up for us in a major way. It's like he understood exactly like what I was trying to say in that rap and just took it a step further. But anyway, it's like, yeah, I will walk these cities, because I want to know what people who live on the ground live like. Like you talk about, like the working class. I'm not interested in like a polished or a catered experience. Like I definitely want to. Friends of mine, like when I show up in their cities, like I ask them like, just take me where you would go. Like what would you do if I weren't here? Like
I like
what would
that. I
you,
like that.
yeah, it's like what would you get into? Like, who would you be meeting up with? Like I want to share that experience with you. I think, and I've been mulling this over for a long time, I think the word authenticity gets thrown around in a lot of ways where it becomes a weapon and becomes a distraction. I think everyone is capable of having and creating authentic experiences that are meaningful, and that it's our responsibility to one another as human beings to just recognize that my authentic might be different than your authentic, might be different than the next person's authentic. and that we give ourselves, just the best opportunity to learn and listen to one another. It's very easy to say like, oh, pull me up to like dude's house, where he's making tacos, on a Blackstone, because I want an authentic experience. And it is, right? But it's only one kind of authentic experience. And we're robbing ourselves of a more immersive experience in our own humanity and the humanity of others when we sort of like let social media and the internet dictate what's authentic, what's not, what's real, what's not. We've already spent a lot of time doing that in our own respective music scenes over the last 30 years, talking about who's real and who's not and who deserves it and who doesn't. And for me is like sort of like disarming that a little bit, just for myself, is like, let me just get on the ground and walk.
Man, Marty, you're a soothsayer. You're such a soothsayer. You're such a healer, and truly, this is just like, man, this is like going to the park, as you were saying, right there in South Pasadena, hanging out a little bit with the mountainside nearby, and just chopping it up with your neighbor. Because what reason do you have not to do that? What reason do you have to turn away from your counterparts out here in this scene, out here on this rock? And so, with a few of these things in mind, knowing that you're interested in being present, especially through this year and going forward, in more ways than one, and considering that you have this album, that you've got Heal Thyself out there for the masses to sift through, for the globe to tap into, for the listenership of this podcast to learn about far and wide, I want to ask you what's next for you as an artist personally. So this is to say, now that you've got one album to your credit, what is it that you are looking forward to? What is it that you've got in mind that you don't necessarily have to have a timeline for, but that you're eyeing out, that you're scoping out as being next for you in this game, in this scene, in this journey that you've taken upon yourself?
Absolutely. I would say that I spent like the majority of like the last 3+ years since the album came out, embracing joy, embracing healing. Is very much a traumatizing experience to make this album for me. A lot of my dead friends are on it. They helped me write it. And so I recognized like through most of 2020, I mean, and in a lot of ways, I appreciate that the pandemic happened the way that it did, because it gave me the space to reflect on what I actually needed versus what I anticipated. Because, if the pandemic had not happened, I would have never taken the time to just sit, be with myself, actually spend some time to heal. I mean, I was in the throes of alcohol abuse. There's definitely a point in time. I'm a type 2 diabetic, and there was definitely a point in time where I was abusing my prescription medication, and just not showing up, for my wife and my daughter, at the time. Very much still in this concept of like, being like an active musician, and trying to garner some attention toward this album. But I'm just really grateful that, because it put a pause on everything, I could definitely talk, relatively clearly about like what I actually needed. And not to say that, that most of the last 3 years have been easy for that. Even in recognizing it, it's like those are still some very difficult steps to take, to break my relationship with alcohol, to honor my relationship with my suite of doctors, and finally quit smoking, over a year ago. And to honor myself and my body and the capacity that my body carries in this lifetime, knowing that I've experienced and done irreversible damage to it. I was asking myself, so like, what can I do now that I'm here, now that I'm insulin dependent? What can I do to raise my quality of life, but also raise my spiritual frequency. So that's so much of what like the last 3 years have been. I work in nonprofit. I work at a children's museum called Kansas Children's Discovery Center. We serve a statewide audience, and I spend a lot of traveling, a lot of time traveling to a statewide audience through our museum programs. And I would say that like post this album, it's just really given me a lot of time to reflect on who I want to be like as a musician, but also who I want to be as a human being. And you know, the types of relationships that I want to cultivate, not only as a person who expresses themselves, but also as a human being. We as a band between Daniel Geese and I have had a variety of tribulations on personal levels that we've experienced since we started making the album in 2016 to when it finally came out in 2020. And I think we all recognize that if we are going to be able to do this into our, you know, my bandmates in their case, into their 30s, going into their 40s, you know, me embarking on my 40s into my 50s, if we want to do this for as long as we say we want to, there were some things that we had to hit the pause button on. And I feel like it's given me a really healthy perspective about how I want to express myself, what parts of the music industry I'm interested in, what parts I'm not at all. It's allowed us to fold back into community in a way that has really resonated with like a whole new generation of Kansas City concert goers.
Hey.
You know, in ways that it didn't have to happen like this, you know. But I'm grateful. I mean, like down on Stadium Drive, like near Kauffman Stadium and Arrowhead Stadium, there's a pair of venues called Farewell and Howdy. A lot of like my old friend Aaron Rhodes, you know, I've watched him grow up from when, you know, starting when I was his age, you know, starting from like when he's like 15, 16, 17, like going and covering live local music in the Kansas City area to, you know, being, you know, a spearhead for a lot of what's happening. So he helps book shows at those two venues. But between him and all the people that operate these DIY venues, it's been so cool to see what they've been able to cultivate for Kansas City and like prop them up in a way that like, this is where bands come to play from all over the country. You know, this is where you know all the hardcore bands come and play. This is where all the punk bands come and play. They're very genre diverse, and so like there's no gatekeeping there that's happening there. It's a safe community, and it's been crazy like for us the last couple of years. You know, as shows have begun to materialize post COVID, post lockdown rather, that a lot of those kids have really embraced us, which feels really good because it's like, you know, so much of where we're at sonically and what we're trying to do isn't about trying to fit into anything or trying to subscribe to anything or point anybody in the direction of anything. I mean, it's very, I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, it would be silly for me to be like, oh, like, you know, we just came up with this on our own. Like, yeah, noise rap is like a huge influence on us. But I've always said, like in the same way that like, you know, an artist like Blackie or Clipping, you know, or even a Death Grips might be an influence on us. I mean, I grew up listening to Public Enemy. I grew up listening to Beastie Boys. You know, we all grew up with Rage Against the Machine.
Chuck
Deftones, it's
D's
one
on
of
the album.
exactly. And it's like this, you know, it's like not only was I trying to capture sonically all of these different references over, you know, across like, you know, 25 years of music, but also like I'm trying to put you in like the early 90s. I'm trying to put you in early 90s Central Topeka, like when this stuff was going down, you know. And I feel like, you know, I mean, through this conversation, but even prior to this, I knew that was something that you understood really, really well. And there's only been a few other people that I think have really like sunk their teeth into the album and understood like this is very much like a snapshot, not only of my life, but the lives of like tens of thousands of other people like who grew up in this community, in these communities. And And more than anything, I just wanted that to resonate. Like I wanted people to see themselves reflected in the work and see some semblance of themselves and the people that they knew and that they grew up with in these stories. I mean, Skylar, like you mentioned from Bel-Air, I mean, yeah, that first verse was real. I was not even 11. We were half a block from Fally's Market on 10th and Jewel. And I was detained for like a half hour by like six cops. And luckily, because it was such a huge police presence in the neighborhood, my dad knew I had walked over at Fally's, and so he came over to find out what was going on. He sees me like standing out in front of Fally's with all of these uniformed officers, and we're just my dad's a child of Mississippi. Civil rights, Mississippi. My mom's older uncles were original members of the Biloxi chapter of the NAACP. So,
Reconstruction era history all over Mississippi.
bro, and so like this is all incredibly familiar to me, and it was like that was the first moment like where I sort of woke up to the reality that I was faced with. In Central Topeka, and all of our friends, like, being detained on a very regular basis. But yeah, these stories are real. These stories are real. Even the ones that I made up, even the ones that I made up are real. These are people that I knew, and this is why they came out the way that they did. So, no, I'm just grateful to be able to talk with somebody who's taken some time to just, sit with the album and glean that level of understanding from it. I don't take that for granted, which is why I wanted to circle back and have this conversation with you because, in a world like we live in, and people are really impatient and artists are really impatient with the art that they make, but also with people's like response to it, that's still something that means something to me. Anybody who's like spent some real time with it, like that still means something. I'll never not appreciate like somebody just taking time with it. I got all kinds of Easter eggs on the album I've never talked about,
For
so
sure.
yeah.
For sure. It's interesting because what I realize through your telling of it is that actually there's still more to recover from the album. That is to say, especially when you mentioned the Easter eggs, for example, when you school me about Cooper coming out of Kansas City, now being in LA with Bel-Air and so on, there's actually still more to get across about this album. And so I can see that far more after speaking with you, because even as I revisited the album over this past weekend, I realized, wow, there are parts to this that I'm just tapping into. I hadn't noticed your particular placement of a pace on the album until earlier, when I go from the vibe on Chuck D's. And then there's like a shift over at Heir Apparent. There's a whole situation there. I realize, oh, there's a reason that we pause in this way, that we introduce a violin into the sound, because it's not to be categorized, it's not to be pigeonholed in simply one direction. It's actually going to surprise you a little bit, because why shouldn't it? That's why this album took so long to produce. And so naturally, it's going to take some time for the listener to truly come to terms with just as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And what I'll tell you too is that we had performed variations of Heir Apparent. We had performed variations of Bloodletting in the live setting before the album came out. And there's nothing just speaking back, to my Christian upbringing. I made a new acquaintance last summer. Our label hosted a 10th anniversary party. So a lot of us on the label were able to come together and play like a couple of sold out nights in Kansas City at a place called Record Bar, another incredible establishment. And I made a new acquaintance, a young woman named Neva, who came up to me afterwards and said, like, I've just never experienced anything like that before, like in a rock club. And I talked to her a little bit about it and was like, what do you mean? And like, we continue that conversation on IG, and she was like, I just felt like there were like some real like sincere elements of worship happening. Like, so whether that's like,
Right.
you know, so whether that's like in a meditative state or you know, in a very aggressive, like, you know, like bloodletting kind of way. It was like one of the first times in a while, like, where I've been able to have like a conversation with somebody about like those elements that I really was insistent on creating, not only on the album, but in the live setting, that not, you know, it's, there was a point where it was very much simply about just subversion, like subverting what people understood about hip hop, what people understood about genre, all those things. Like, and then there came a point where like that's not really enough. Like, that's not substantial enough. I don't just want to be subversive for the sake of. I want to be sincere. I want to be earnest. And that was the thing that is what earnestly came out of me, is a sense of like, you know, sonic liberation. Wanting, you know, there's plenty of times where it's like the music is playing, you know, that big cello swell at the beginning of Heir Apparent, and I just go like sit in front of the speakers, you know, and just spend time with it, like in a very literal communion, you know, with the music as it's happening. And and I'm just very grateful that we created a body of work that hopefully can allow that to happen for others. I don't want to like sort of hide behind being cool anymore, or hide behind like a facade of, you know, where we exist in like a larger conversation about noise rap or any of those things. Like, none of that is it for me. And anybody who has spent some time talking with me or talking with any of us about the music that we make hopefully comes away with an understanding of that, is like, you know, we're not just here to just do a thing that sort of fits and works for what's happening in the world. This is something like very primal for me, like very ancient. And that's how this started for me in 2010. And that's, you know, if and whenever it does end, that's how it ends too, you know, is like there's gonna be plenty of times. You know, I talked to people who are like, gosh, what did they say? They were like, do you feel like with your album coming out in 2020 that maybe like you sort of missed the wave? And I was like, no, because like it just it, that because that never mattered, you know. That wasn't really the point. Like, I didn't make this, you know, we didn't make this album to, you know, try to catch Death Grips wave, you know, back in 2012, or try to catch Blackie's wave years before that. Like, I made that like in commune with the music, and also as a reflection of what I was hearing that was resonating in me, you know. You know, I've talked to Blackie a few times, you know, down in Houston, about just how much, you know, his music resonates, and like how real it is for me. Is like if something changes your life, you do what you can to honor it, and it's not about like chasing clout or trying to like fit into a thing. It's, you do it because you have to, you're supposed to, you know. So yeah, as far as what's next, just chasing that, but also, like, you know, in some ways, like I think of Heal Thyself and all of the assets, the album cover, some of the videos, and the animation that we did for it, very much as like grayscale, like snow on the TV, you know, where things like just sort of pop in and out. And I want to bring more color into our world. And so I think that's what's next. More color. However we decide to interpret that.
Man, that is so much fun, and I'm so proud of you on behalf of our communities from Los Angeles out to Topeka. I have to let you know that for you to put this down with us in mind, with the history of hip hop and the history of the intersections between hip hop and not just Christianity, but urban living and urban survival in, as you were saying earlier, post-century America, to know that you have kept in mind the way that our communities have persevered and the way that our communities can be memorialized through this medium, That I have to let you know is a standing achievement, is something that you should absolutely be taking all this time to keep sifting through and to keep sharing anecdotes about, because all of us out here, those of us who may doubt our stories, those of us who may doubt our talents, those of us who may doubt the relevance of our experiences in these big cities that wash away so much on a daily basis and pretend as though it's not there, as though it was never there, we can see Heal Thyself and note that actually we can tell these stories in such a way that stand the test of time. And that others will see wherever they might be, because this sound and this movement and the passion for the perseverance of these things is unmistakable on the album and in your work and in your ongoing telling of how these things came to be. So I want to let you know that absolutely, I completely recommend Heal Thyself to the Los Cuentos listenership, to anybody in Los Angeles who came up listening to these jams in the 90s, especially to anybody who's interested in learning about the 90s, because it seems like such a standalone era. By all means, check out Heal Thyself, check out Ebony Tusks, check out their YouTube channel, see a little bit about what they've put together so far, and let it be heard, let it be known that this album is on the map for all of us, be it in LA or New York or Topeka. And I see it, I hear it. I have to let the city know 100%, Marty.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, yeah, and it's my great pleasure and great honor, and the truth is that even just coming to terms with the idea that maybe we live in a world where it would just be impossible to create the kind of critical mass where everybody could hear it. It's like obviously like in an ideal world, I would love for everybody to hear this and like to take their time with it, but I just have to say, like, just what a treat it is for you to have reached out so long ago and spent so much time with the album and allowing it to resonate in you. That's something I will just I'll never get over. I'll never stop appreciating. So JT, just thank you for this time. I'm so excited to watch you continue to engage, with the communities and the neighborhoods that you serve and live alongside in Los Angeles. I think that's the coolest part too, is that, your platform is not your platform, just there's just like a coalescing of just so many elements and so many things that I think speak to what culture really is in real time. And that's something that you can't put a price tag on. That's
Hey.
something that people don't always identify with, because people are used to seeing things that are fake and facades, and that's only going to get worse, as far as the internet is concerned. But there are so many people who just long for real connections and real humanity, and that's what comes through in what you do. So just thank you for this space and this time, just allowing me to share a little bit of mine. It's real cool.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. It's been my honor. And I got to let you know too, Marty, that this is the first of more combos between us, because I've just
Yeah.
had such an excellent time hearing your voice and being there with you, even if only at a glance, through Topeka, through Wichita, through KC, through the whole Midwest, as you've come to see it. And by all means, I gotta let you know that when you make your way across LA and California again, including that SF side, you've got a pal in me. I will 100% invite you to eat some, to drink some, to chill some with our community, with these neighborhoods, because we know that you honor them just the same on your end of things, Marty. So really, man,
That's right.
what's going on with you for the rest of the evening?
For the rest of the evening, so my daughter decided they wanted to have their hair straightened for the first time, and so mom's gonna help them with that, which is hilarious. We'll see how that goes. Just for the rest of the evening, just getting ready for spring break at the Children's Museum. We got lots of great programming to come, and I think I'll do a little bit of reading. I don't read nearly as often as I would like to, but I think I'm gonna sit down and read a little bit. And life is happening. Life is happening. I really enjoy it now. I really enjoy it now, despite all the ups and downs. I'm enjoying life happening, and so I think that's where I'll be tonight.
So grateful for you. So grateful for you saying that. One final wraparound question, just because I gotta know, between Team Carlton or Team Will, are you playing lacrosse or are you playing basketball?
Oh man, that's funny. Oh, I played basketball in middle school, but I wasn't very good. I was a power forward in eighth grade and just trash. All my friends know I'm really bad at basketball. I have a nephew who's playing D1 in St. Charles, Missouri, outside of St. Louis. He goes to Lindenwood University, and he's just tremendously gifted. I'm very proud of him. I gotta go lacrosse just because, like, no, basketball's not it for me. I love playing basketball too, but I'm so bad.
Oh, that's so good. That's so good. So yeah,
Plus,
don't.
like, plus, I'm a closet preppy, and a lot of people know that about me too. It's like I'm really like Benetton is back, Esprit is back, Bonobos is back. That was a whole other part of my life. Like I came up like I mean I went to public school, but definitely into like preppy stuff. So,
Oh,
yeah,
then Carlton is 100% for
that's my
you.
guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like popping pills and and
Well,
playing
that other part,
lacrosse.
about that other part, we'll get to another time. But yeah, I mean, I'm rooting for Carlton. I'm rooting for him in season three. That should be out later this year. And man, I'm so glad we got to pay some homage to the show, to
Oh,
the creators
absolutely.
out here.
You want to talk about just a fundamental experience that so many of us share too, just again that dichotomy of coming from inner city life and being thrust in a world that you were so unfamiliar with, but that's also very unfamiliar with you. Just big up Coop and everybody on his team over there for creating something just so arresting and so memorable. It's cool to be a part of that legacy. Super cool.
It's Jimbo times.